I will now turn it over to Mrs. Holmes and the candidates for our question and answer. We want to also say that we did have some cancellations due to family emergencies, and we have several members, candidates, who might be coming a little delayed. So thank you for your patience, and we will begin the question and answer forum.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for being here. It's important. Candidates, thank you as well. Just want to go over a few ground rules just to make sure that we are all on the same page. I'm sure they are very well versed. I've seen you all traversing the city from forum to forum, discussing the issues that you believe are pertinent to different communities. Of course, this forum is a discussion. It is not a debate. So what we're doing here is we're having conversations, getting answers to questions, and we're doing this all kindly and gently. You have been arranged in alphabetical order. Some folks are here, some folks are not. We've already addressed that. What will happen is you'll get a one-minute time frame to introduce yourself or introduce remarks or share those, whatever. Then what we'll do is we'll move to questions. Some of these questions require a yes or no answer, and you'll say yes or no or whatever you say. Some of the questions also require more of an in-depth response, and so you'll get 60 to 90 seconds to respond. I will be timing, and someone else will be too, so please don't be offended if we give you the hook or say time, you know, like a boxing, you know, okay? Once we get past that, we will also have questions on note cards from those folks here in the sanctuary and then also from the live stream, all right? Once we finish with that, then each of you will have an opportunity to summarize your thoughts, your remarks, what you want folks to know about you or where you are with particular issues, and you'll have a minute to do that. So, shall we begin? All righty. Let us begin with introductions. Congressman.
Good afternoon, and thank you for hosting this candidate forum. It's always quite a blessing and experience to be at Trinity. Today is no exception. I want to reintroduce myself. I've been around in Chicagoland for quite a long time. My roots come out of Chicago organizing and advocacy and community building and development. I've worked spearheading programs to address conditions of young people, to open up school buildings after school hours for the entire community. Violence prevention as well, have a network of people who I've collaborated with across the city of Chicago. And yes, I am a politician. I've been a member of the Chicago City Council, proud to have roots in the Harold Washington era as we elected Harold Washington, got to the work of redefining the role of city government, making the most inclusive government in the history of the city a reality, and dismantling the Chicago machine. In addition to that, I've worked in the state Senate, been a member of the Black Caucus in the state Senate. I've been a member of the Cook County Board. I was floor leader for Tony Preckwinkle for 8 years. And over the past 4 years, I've been in Congress delivering for Chicago in areas of job creation, infrastructure development, green investments.
Time.
And I'm running for mayor because I think I'm best equipped. Thank you.
Jamal?
My name is Jamal Green, and I'm running for mayor because I want to fulfill the hope of Chicago. You know, we talked about Harold Washington, and it has been a long time since folks have been hopeful that there can be tangible results that can come to their communities. And all of the politicians since then have lied and joined the Chicago machine to continue to oppress our neighborhoods. I'm running because we need a change. We have someone on every level of government in this race. And the reality is we don't see the urgency in these neighborhoods when it comes to gun violence. We don't see the urgency in these neighborhoods where our young people are continuing to suffer. The urgency in these neighborhoods for seniors who are scared to get out of their cars when they're being carjacked. And it's time for someone, a new leader, someone new, that's not the same old, they're going to give you the same old political rhetoric, to move forward a plan to really bring all people together in this city, bring back the hope of all people throughout
time.
Chicago to have a better future that we can all believe in.
Commissioner.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Brandon Johnson. I represent the west side of Chicago and the western suburbs as a Cook County commissioner. The best job, though, that I've ever had is that of a public school teacher, teaching middle school, in Cabrini Green, USA, and teaching high school at Westinghouse on the west side of Chicago, where my wife and I are raising our three children. Look, teaching in Cabrini Green is really where my politics begin to mature, because the neighborhood of Cabrini Green captures the very essence of the city of Chicago. And what that looks like is that my students could see, smell, touch one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the entire city of Chicago from their back windows, while staring at them every single day, bulldozers preparing to destroy their public housing. That's the reality that many families are experiencing in the city of Chicago, where we are chasing down an economy that's behind us while everything in front of us is crumbling. But that's why I'm running for mayor of Chicago, to finally put an end to this tale of two cities and
Time.
Usher in a better, stronger Chicago.
Alderman.
Good afternoon. My name is Sophia King, and I'm running for mayor because I love the city. However, we are at a pivotal point. We need a mayor who leads with collaboration. We also need a mayor who understands how to represent the entire city and not just segregated parts of it. I represent currently as alderman, as a mother, as a sister, from downtown to Hyde Park with Bronzeville in the middle. And because of the unwieldy crime, the number one request I get is for more police presence. But we know that we have to get to the root causes, so we have to deal with violence intervention and bring resources there, too. I have a plan that does that immediately. Immediately. We need to address these root causes. I know that we can have safety and justice, that we can build downtown and build our neighborhoods, that we can prepare our kids for college and the trades. An equitable Chicago is a strong Chicago.
Time.
And a strong Chicago is a safe Chicago.
Thank you for those opening remarks. We will move to questions now. Remember, what we will do is do alphabetical order. So, in essence, the first question will go first to the congressman, and then the next question, then Mr. Green will go first, the next question, commissioner, you get the idea, okay? So, congressman, here is the question for all of you, and we'll start with Congressman. What do you view as the most pressing issue facing the mayor's office, and how would you address it?
The most pressing issue is leadership. Chicago hasn't seen that type of leadership. I supported this mayor 4 years ago when she sought my endorsement, and I provided it. Leadership is about bringing people together. Leadership is about engaging community. Leadership is about seeking out ideas and plans that people have in Chicago neighborhoods to make them a priority. The mayor's first responsibility in a city like Chicago is public safety, ensuring that people feel safe to walk, to go to work, to go to school, to do the things they want to do. I've put forth a public safety plan that addresses how we can do that in Chicago, by working to rebuild trust, by ensuring that there is police accountability, by ensuring that we modernize the police department through modernization and implementation of the consent decree, and yes, by ensuring that we have police officers deployed to reestablish and work with communities across Chicago to reinstill trust and confidence, to have community policing and constitutional policing. What we have witnessed over the past few days that took place in Memphis. Intolerable. It must end. Training is key to that. Holding people accountable. The consent decree is the roadmap to making that happen.
Thank you.
Can you repeat
Mr. Green?
The question?
Yes,
the
I
question?
Can.
I just want to make sure.
Not a problem.
And the time, please.
Well, I'm being told now that I'm supposed to give you either 60 or 90. My understanding was
right.
It was 60 to 90. So because the congressman got 90 seconds, everybody else will this question. And then what we'll do is we will, depending on the complexity of the question, it might be only 60 seconds or only 90 seconds. So
okay.
I apologize for my misunderstanding, but you all won't pay for that. So here we go. So you will have, each of you will have 90 seconds, the remainder 90 seconds for this particular question. Again, Mr. Green, the question is, what do you view as the most pressing issue facing the mayor's office, and how would you address it?
The most pressing issue facing the mayor's office is moving forth a plan on how we're going to make people feel safe in the city, right? I think that's number one. And one of those pieces is, how do we get to public safety? And the problem that we have is that we continue to have corrupt leadership that continue doing the same things of the past. We got many candidates in this race who want to do the same things of the past. We got to first understand that over-policing neighborhoods does not equal more safety. You cannot continue trying to contain crime. You have to actually tackle it. So we move for the most comprehensive public safety plan than anyone in this race, and it's called EPIC. The EPIC stands for Economic Prosperity, Prevention, Intervention, and CPD Reform. The first thing that we're talking about, we're not talking about police. We're talking about how to create prosperous neighborhoods. We're talking about how we're going to use a single-family mortgage bond to back 10,000 home loans to repopulate neighborhoods. We're talking about how we're going to increase affordable housing supply and have incentives to do so. And we're also talking about how to push people out of poverty with giving $1,000 to 10,000 families and with a few caveats to it so that folks can get the foundation that they need so that they can live healthy and sustainable lives. So economic prosperity, prevention, so that we can make sure that another generation of young people don't engage in a life of crime where they can start school at 3 years old with universal 3K. And then we're going to reopen up the mental health facilities and do a whole bunch of public safety measures that are holistic.
Thank you for the question. Look, the serious problem that we're all dealing with is public safety. Because of the inequities and the disinvestment that has existed for too long, we're all feeling less safe. I mentioned that my wife and I have said this repeatedly. We're raising our children on the west side of Chicago. I love Austin, but it is one of the more violent neighborhoods in the entire city. It's not enough to love city. You have to love people. And that's why, because of the challenges that we've had, like having to change a window from one of the bullets that have come through our home, when my 15-year-old rides his bike, we fear for his safety. It's why, as Cook County Commissioner, we've invested the largest amount of money in the history of county government into violence prevention. We've also tackled medical debt to make sure that people are not losing their homes to continue to create the economic security that our families deserve. Here's the thing. As mayor of the city of Chicago, I'm going to have the most robust youth hiring operation that this city has experienced. It's going to be year-round. There's a direct correlation between youth employment and violence reduction. I'm going to pass treatment, not trauma. 24 hours access to individuals who are experiencing mental health crises, that there's a mental health crisis professional there to treat you. Over 40% of the calls, or 40% of the calls that come through are mental health crises. If we actually free up the law enforcement to deal with where 40% of the violence that happens, which is 6% of the entire city of Chicago, that's a smart plan and taking it seriously. The fact that we are spending more money on jails and incarceration than educating young people, that's unconscionable under my administration. That's not going to happen. A better, stronger, safer Chicago.
Same question. I love when folks pick up on our plans because they should be distributed right away. So safety is a number one, two, and three issue that we're facing as a city, and leadership is a strong part of that. This is why we have a plan that looks at it comprehensively. We have to get to the immediacy of crime now. When somebody has a gun at your head, long-term plans are not going to deal with that. So we do need police as part of the plan, but they are not the only solution, which is why we are calling for hundreds of millions of dollars into violence intervention. Not only that, that comes with incentives to bring our young folks off the streets into legal jobs, job training, mental health support, wraparound services, all of those things. We do also know that over 50% of calls to 911 are for nonviolent offenses. They're for mental health insecurities. They're for homeless insecurities. So we do need to have alternative responses to police. As aldermen, we piloted a program to do that. Unfortunately, those programs have not been scaled up because of the lack of leadership. Another program, we put $85 million on the street for violence intervention as a city councilman. This mayor has not spent $5 million of that in 2022, so we've got that to spend in 2023. But it's a priority, so we need to get those resources on the street, and we need the leadership to do that. That's why I'm here. Thank you.
All right. We will have 60 seconds for the next question. We will begin the questions or the responses this time with Mr. Green. Oh, and by the way, I need to let everyone know that the questions that are coming in from the sanctuary, from folks that are actually physically here, remember, these should be questions that any of the candidates and all of the candidates can address, not questions that are directed to one particular individual. Those will not get asked, because the whole idea is to get as much information out as possible. Okay, so just if you need to recraft a question, then do that and just send another card back, okay? All right. Mr. Green, here we go. Here's a question for everyone. This is more like an economic question. Neighborhoods are being plagued with absentee landlords and abandoned properties. Residents, obviously, severely impacted by this. What's your plan to make these property owners accountable for their property and making neighborhoods safe?
And make a neighborhood safe? Is what that was the end of that question? All right. So, you know, when we talk about housing, this is a huge problem. We have a lot of property owners who are in neighborhoods that own big buildings that are not being used. And the city also has a lot of properties that we aren't repurposing, from abandoned school buildings on down the line. We have a crisis on our hands, right? We need to build affordable housing supply in record time. So some of the things that we talked about doing is, incentivizing single floor commercial buildings so that we can build a floor on top. Loosening up the single family ordinance so folks can also build on top or use their basements as garden units so that we can build affordable housing in record time. We also have to repurpose these buildings, and we got to go to these private owners to acquire these buildings and use every measure that we can to take hold of those buildings if they're not going to do something with them. This is a crisis. We have to build affordable housing, and we also have a lot of other basic needs that we have to address in the communities.
Well, thank you for the question. A few years ago, as an organizer, I worked with Alderwoman Pat Dowd to hold banks and these larger entities that hold these properties, and they refuse to put them back on the tax roll, to hold those banks accountable. And so under my administration, we're going to strengthen that ordinance, especially these larger banks that continue to get away with the abandonment. But this is also an opportunity for us to expand what I'm referring to as our workforce development. There are many people who are unhoused. We can actually close the gap between education and job opportunities by giving young people the skills that they need and the trades and other dynamics that allow them to rehab the homes, to deal with the vacancy, put the homes back on the tax roll, and then incentivize individuals who want to have a pathway to home ownership to purchase those homes, like my wife and I experienced, where we received down payment assistance from the government to purchase a home. So this is an economic opportunity, but it's also an opportunity to put people in homes, but it's also an opportunity to hold banks accountable. And under my administration, we're going to do that.
Yeah, so some of our biggest landlords in this city are resourced by our government. HUD supplies resources to thousands of buildings in the city of Chicago, CHA. The fifth floor needs to hold them accountable. I know for sure, because I sat down with the regional director of HUD, a lot of the resources that they give out, market rate rent, to these landlords who become slumlords and they're not held accountable. We have to hold them accountable. I lead what's been called one of the most equitable developments in the city of Chicago, the former Michael Reese development by the New York Times. And we've got a $25 million commitment for education. We've got a commitment to 20% affordable housing on site. So when you have good leadership, you can leverage it to make sure and hold people accountable. I would hold entities like HUD and other big government resources accountable so that they can hold their landlords accountable so that our people can live in the dignity that they deserve.
Absentee landlords. As a former housing counselor and organizing with Neighborhood Housing Services, I would do some practical things. As a former member of the Chicago City Council, I would direct the Department of Buildings and the Department of Streets and Sanitation, people who are on the ground, who have knowledge of who landlords are, especially absentee landlords, to work with community organizations, including block clubs, to identify those buildings to take action. I used to go to housing court to take action on vacant buildings, slumlord-owned buildings, to hold them accountable. That is what you do. It's a practical measure. It also helps empower block clubs and community organizations to have greater knowledge about their community. This is community building. This is how you make communities get healthier, make accountability a reality. That is my experience in the field. Thank you.
Thank you for that. What I've decided to do is I'm going to interdisperse some of these questions from our audience here just so they don't feel left out. So now this question, we will start with the commissioner. And this is a yes or no question for all of the candidates. And then we will do a follow-up question in reference to the one I'm about to ask. So, are you in favor of an elected school board? Yes or no?
Yes.
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 Okay. See, that went well there, right? It all could be so easy, right? All right. This is a little more complicated. And then we'll start the second. This will be our second part of that question. So I think we should still remain. We'll start with the commissioner again.
Just yes.
Please. Okay. Yeah, we already got. Listen, we did that. That was great, though. That was great. I love that. Their question from, I guess, combination of church members and then also folks here. Why do you feel CPS should or should not move to this elected school board? And that's their question.
Yeah, I mean, so look, we fought for an elected representative school board. And many of you in this room, we stood shoulder to shoulder. I've done it as an organizer where we've went all over the city of Chicago collecting signatures because that's what the people of the city of Chicago want. That's what they deserve. Anytime we have an opportunity to expand democracy for our people, we should be doing that. And here's why this is important, because under mayoral control, it has been an absolute failure. School privatization, the closure of schools, the firing of black veteran teachers, which have undermined the working class of our communities, the fact that you don't have a system that's committed to paying into people's retirement. If you were to remove pensioners out of black zip codes, our entire economy would collapse. You have individuals, both political parties, that have been an enemy of public education, and public education at the expense of the state, after all, is a Negro idea.
Can you repeat the question? I think you said why the elected school board.
Again. So the question is, they wanted to know, is why do you feel CPS should move or not move toward an elected school board?
Sure. So I think an elected process is always a good part so that we hear the voices of the people. I think the issue with any election, including this one, is special interests get involved. And so you always have to be cognizant of that. And so even with elections, you have people who put money into things. You know, we've got one of my opponents has $500,000 investment in his campaign. So you always have to be cognizant of that. But the best that we can do to represent the voice of the elected or of our constituencies is always the best. But what I will say about CPS is there are some priorities that we have to do. We definitely have to bring the trades back to the schools in a very meaningful way. I have a plan that does
hold
such
your applause,
just
please.
That.
Hold your applause. I'm sorry, Alderman. Go
I thought
ahead.
You said for me to hold. Okay. Can I reclaim some time?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Cool.
About three seconds.
I have a plan that does just that. Again, leveraging the fifth floor to make sure that we're teaching our kids about the jobs that are coming up in the future. We have to be and embrace the technology. 80% of jobs are going in that direction, but our kids are not being trained for those jobs. So in order to have and prepare our kids for the jobs of the future, we have to bring the trades back to the schools.
I supported an elected school board, and now it's the law. It's going to be 21 persons who will be taking office in 2027. This will be challenging. However, given my experience as a member of the city council, the state senate, county board, and in Congress, I know how to work with collective bodies and legislatures. This is, in a sense, a legislative body in that it is large. I will work to make it work so that we have the best representation possible. I, too, am concerned about the influence of big money in who will get elected. It's why I introduced a bill, an ordinance on the county board to bring public financing to those elections. It would essentially ensure that all candidates have the same access to the same money and no one gets an unfair advantage. That's what I've been striving for. That's how you ensure that the voice of voters is actually reflected at the ballot box. But I'm prepared to work with the elected school board.
Thank you all for that, and I appreciate your patience with me.
Well, you know, democracy is always important, especially when we've been depending on CPS leadership as well as union leadership. We now will have democracy so that folks can sit on the board and actually make decisions on behalf of CPS. CPS is terrible. Kids are being failed each and every day walking in those school buildings. And the only people that are benefiting are the privatizers. Those privatizers who aren't even from Chicago, who are providing terrible food, who schools are rodent infested. I mean, we have real problems going on in our school systems, and we need to bring back public, good-paying union jobs so that we can take care of our children because we know how to take care of our children. Our kids don't have the wraparound services that they need. Schools should be open throughout the day and on weekends with massive programming. We need to make sure that no kid is on the streets, that we have a program for them or an apprenticeship for them so we can set them up for a better future, because our kids are smarter than Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, and we got to invest in them so that they can fulfill their fullest potential.
Thank you. Let's switch gears a little bit. Some in the sanctuary here, as well as on the live stream, have questions about addressing the issues of the juvenile justice system. One question is, how do you propose to address the ineffective juvenile justice system, which doesn't currently hold juveniles accountable for their crimes? Alderman, we will start with you. I guess, should we do 90 seconds on this one? Let's do 90 seconds.
Yeah, so I think, first of all, again, leading with collaboration on this, there's been a lot of finger pointing around why we have the crime that we have. Everybody's pointing at each other. It's the chief judge's fault. It's the state's attorney's fault. It's we need to look within our own house and to figure out where the gaps are. Everybody has gaps within their house. And in order for us to really get at this issue, we have to make sure that we collaborate around that. I know that the chief judge's office has diversion programs. You know, are those diversion programs meeting the needs of our kids? Our plan recommends that we kind of all come together. I talked a little bit earlier about violence intervention. Well, that would require everybody coming together, including the churches, to put their hands on our kids, to make sure, again, that they have the wraparound services that they need, because we know that that dysfunction comes from a dysfunctional family, and we're all dysfunctional. What does a family need? What does the child need? Training them for their jobs of the future, making sure that they have mental health support. That's going to come from collaboration. Each, the state, the county, the city, all has billions of dollars right now. We need to put hundreds of millions together to make sure that we get to some of these root causes, but we're all doing stuff individually. There's no collaboration around that. Under my leadership, that
Time.
Would be different. Thank you.
As a former head of a nonprofit community development corporation, I've worked on juvenile justice issues, primarily ensuring that there are alternatives to detention and incarceration of young people. I've been at the juvenile detention center, been in juvenile court, but it's really important to understand that the majority of youth that wind up in the custody of the juvenile court are children who come from desperate situations, broken homes, homelessness, exposure to violence and trauma, drug addiction, on and on. By the time they fall into custody of the juvenile system, it is very, very challenging. It's important, I think it's a responsibility that we have to ensure that they get the treatment, that they get the help that they need, wraparound services. This will only happen when the city of Chicago becomes an active partner in working with the juvenile courts, in working with the state's attorney, working with other stakeholders in the neighborhoods where those youth are coming from to come up with tangible solutions. But clearly, if we don't respond in that manner, then we will soon graduate them to Cook County Jail and state penitentiary. And that is an admission of failure of our policy to address the needs of young people.
You know, I'm really sick of how Chicago treats our young people. We make them martyrs. We make them into, you know, just even when you look on the media, there's nothing positive that they say. And when you walk in our neighborhoods, we got daycares and churches. But where are the safe spaces for young people that are 16 to 24, right, that are going through that phase? You know, one of the things that we're going to do is we're going to implement a youth intervention department in which we're going to hire youth interventionists that will have priority of resources to put young people on the right path. So kids who drop out of school, kids who get arrested, they would have first priority over those young people to give them free mental health counseling, to give them housing, a job opportunity, to mandate them to a mentoring organization instead of continuously going through the cycle in a juvie system. See, what happens is we don't intervene with young people. Right now, we got 12 and 13-year-old carjackers right now. Now, by the time they get to 16 and they're carrying a gun and somebody responds wrong, then they become a murderer. But we've already seen many different instances that can lead up to that, but nobody intervenes. There's no one. When they go into school, they just get kicked out. They're back into the neighborhood. We have to intervene. And when they make any mistakes, we got to be there to grab them and put them on the right path and give them the services that they need, as well as invest in safe spaces, in the after-school programs, into community centers, so that young people have a place to go in the city of Chicago and not curfew them because they want to go downtown.
You know, when I started teaching over 15 years ago in Chicago, one of the hardest experiences that I've had is looking in the eyes of young people who have been ignored and neglected. That type of pain and trauma is the direct result of past failures of politicians and insiders that have closed schools, shut down public housing. They've made it less safe in the city of Chicago because we've lost economic opportunities, and now we're seeing the manifestation of those failures. And that's why my budget plan lays out a full operation that's going to invest in people. That's what it comes down to, you all. We have to love people enough and be willing to invest in them. In fact, as Cook County Commissioner, I've been working with detention centers all over the country to figure out alternative approaches to how we actually treat young people who are manifesting the trauma. Do y'all know in Keene County in Seattle, Tacoma County, that they have zero juveniles in their detention center because they're investing in young people? That's the type of collaborative spirit that I bring into this operation. But more importantly, you're going to have someone who sees young people, who knows those struggles, that's loving them enough to invest in them. That's what a better, stronger, safer Chicago will look like when we're investing in young people. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's change the topic a little bit. I think you all have addressed it a bit in some of your other responses. This time we will be back starting with the congressman. One of the community members would like to know, how do you propose to address the homeless population in a city that deems itself a sanctuary city for immigrants and provides housing and other supports necessary to live with dignity? I think we should do another 90 seconds on this one.
Thank you. Every neighborhood, in order to be a healthy, safe, thriving neighborhood, needs essential investment. It needs to have good schools. It needs to have good housing. It needs to have access to health care, and it needs to have transportation. when any of those elements are missing, access to groceries and stores and retail, when any of that is missing, you have a community that begins to suffer. When you couple that with historic disinvestment, you have very marginalized, deprived communities. When you are seeking to do a good thing, which is to help people who are fleeing violence and poverty and intolerable conditions, and you seek to relocate them in communities without engaging in dialogue with those communities, there will be conflict. Anytime you want to do anything in a community, you should engage that community. You should be transparent, and you should hear the concerns of that community. I believe in Chicago being a welcoming city. Harold Washington was the first mayor in the country to declare Chicago a welcoming city for immigrants. Remember that the founder of Chicago was a black immigrant from Haiti who was wedded to a Native American woman. So we have a long history and legacy of being a welcoming city. That is what's been missing. Thank you.
Well, I think when in regards to housing and a lot of the basic needs, you know, the folks here in the city of Chicago don't feel that they've been welcome and they've had the basic needs that are due to them. And we must make sure that we change that, right? We have to invest in people. We have project buildings that they knock down, and they promise tens of thousands of affordable housing units, but have we seen them? When you look at Cabrini Green and you look at these neighborhoods that are now $3,000 to live in, but they were promised public housing. When you look at right now, this administration is selling off public land for private developers, for new soccer fields and new schools, but you promised folks public housing. We are 120,000 units behind. So we must make sure that that is a focus. So I talked about earlier some of the things we would do from incentivizing affordable housing and how we would build it. But one of the biggest things that we can do right now to create an economic engine is create a public bank in the city of Chicago. We can have a public bank right here in the city that invests in new homeowners with untraditional finances, that invest into small businesses, invest in the income-based housing development, and then all of the profit that comes back from that bank goes right back to city services. Right plus right equals right. We have to stop allowing folks to be without homes. We got to invest in affordable housing, and we need an economic engine to do so, and we're going to lobby for it.
Yeah. The fact that we have 65,623 individuals in this city who are unhoused, that's unconscionable. It's an entire additional ward. Of many of those individuals that are unhoused are young people. Look, I've taught in our public schools. I've seen the impact of the unhoused and the impact that that has on their learning. And it's hard, you all. We ride through this city. We see it. But the politics of old is why we are in the position that we're in now. And that's why, under a Johnson administration, we're going to pass Bring Chicago Home, because it generates the revenue to be able to get at the crises. And here's the last thing. The way the political structure and those who have an interest to divide our communities continue to do that at the expense of everyone, that's not going to happen under my administration. The same Cook County Hospital that delivered Delia Ramirez is the same county hospital where I went to the Fantas Clinic to have my asthma treated. Of course we have to listen to people. Of course we have to have a plan. And those who are here should be supported. And those who are seeking security here should be supported as well. No one should lose at the expense of someone else. Those type of politics will end under my administration. A better, stronger, safer Chicago that's united. My campaign reflects it. My administration will reflect it as well.
So being welcoming is not the question. It's how we welcome people. So the tension arises when you have and say you're a welcoming city, but your own people don't feel welcomed in their city. And so that's where the tension arises here. We opened our ward up to, because everybody was not in my backyard, to the immigrants. We were one of the first to do that. But before that, we were also one of the first to open up our ward to our community, so to the homeless who are here and experiencing homelessness during this pandemic. So we must make sure that we treat people here as being welcomed in our own community. Like they say, take care of your own house first, and then that's where the tension arises. But also, affordable housing is a responsibility of the entire city and not just segregated portions of it. So we have to grow our housing stock. One of the ways we can do that is through opportunity zones, also through TIFs, which Harold Washington started back in his administration. We need to exercise both of those. Opportunity zones are a vehicle that we have not used. Other big cities have used it. We can invest and bring billions of dollars into black and brown communities to grow the housing stock. That's something that I would do as leader and on the fifth floor and leverage those programs to make sure that we had a good housing stock for our affordable housing and for those who need it the most.
Thank you for that. State Rep, would you like to take a seat? All right. In the vein of housing, there has been a question on the live stream or from the live stream about, in particular, seniors and housing. The question revolves around, what would you do with rising taxes and increase in utilities? How would you help keep seniors in their homes or providing them with affordable, sustainable housing? State Rep, you just got here, so we've been going in alphabetical order. I think we should do, we've been doing either 60 seconds in response or 90 seconds in response. I think this could be a 60-second response question. So why don't we, sir, why don't we start with you and then we'll just work our way down the line.
Okay, thank you. So I think we have a lot of opportunity when it comes to affordable housing, specifically for our aging population. One thing that we've talked about doing is making sure that we not just build supplemental housing for the elderly population through, you know, rehab and nursing homes, but to also create multi-generational housing. The reason why that's a big deal and why that's important is because not only do we want our elderly folks to age in place, but we also want them to be able to impart the wisdom and knowledge that they have on a younger generation as well. And we know that people have a better life expectancy when they're able to do that, right? And so there are dollars there coming from the Illinois Department of Housing. There are dollars there from from HUD in D.C. I think we can create a program in Chicago that does exactly that and not privatize some of these processes, these programs, so that we can build people these affordable housing units so they can age in place with dignity and respect and around their family and around their communities.
Thank you. Congressman.
First of all, the reliance on property taxes is driving property tax increases. And it's a model that's been given to Chicago by Springfield, not by Representative Buckner. It precedes him, his coming to Springfield. It goes back decades. We've got to move away from the over-reliance on property taxes because it's displacing people, including senior citizens, too. And we've got to work to provide property tax relief as we increase funding for schools and for general revenues for municipalities in Illinois. Two, watch out for ComEd. They already announced they want to increase our costs. There is a franchise agreement that is pending with the city of Chicago. We've got to be watchdogs about what gets rolled out potentially in the very near future. Lastly, I would say with the Inflation Reduction Act, which is really an investment in fighting climate change, there will be opportunities
Time.
For solar panels, heat pumps to be installed for people everywhere across the city of Chicago. It's essential for rebuilding
Time,
Chicago
Congress.
Equitably.
Time.
My apologies.
Time.
It was a long sentence.
He can finish a sentence now, Mr. Green. Come on now.
Y'all said time three times.
No. Yeah, that's all right.
You know, this is, when we talk about property taxes, you know, I agree that we cannot continue to rely on this terrible property tax system. So there are a few things that we need to do. One is we got to stop tying our property taxes to inflation as this mayor has done, and we got to get rid of the escalator. That's one of the things, because that's why we just recently got a property tax increase. Two, we would also move forward a city loyalty tax credit for those folks who stay in their homes after 3 years. Each year, all the way up to 20, you get a 2% off of your property taxes all the way up to 20 years. If you're in your home for 20 years or more, you get 40% off of your property taxes. We want folks to stay in the city of Chicago and incentivize folks to own homes in the city of Chicago. Three is we got a lot of folks who are at risk of losing their homes because of taxes. So the city of Chicago should provide no interest loans to help them stay in their homes and pay their taxes and give them time to pay it back. So
time.
We have to address our property tax issue, and we're going to do so.
You know, another serious problem. I mean, we got here because of just the failures of the old politics that continues to rely on property taxes as a way to generate revenue. I released a budget plan in which I've made a commitment not to raise property taxes. We can invest in people without harming the people who need the investments the most. That's why I've called repeatedly. The wealthy in this city, like 71% of Chicagoans have already said, have to pay their fair share for a better, safer Chicago. Look, as Cook County Commissioner, I've built two affordable housing units for seniors. We broke ground on the third one. I made a commitment, and I'm holding to this commitment, not to build on public land that should be there for public housing, which ultimately can help support our seniors. Here's the last thing, you all. We've returned $700,000 of taxes back to the residents of my district by making sure that the exemptions that they qualify for, they're actually benefiting from that. Under my administration, seniors will be not only well-informed, they will have a mayor who is committed to a better, stronger, safer
Time.
Chicago and making sure that the public housing is available for our seniors. Thank you.
It's almost disrespectful how we treat our elders, people who have led the way for us, our elders, people who serve in the armed forces. We have the resources here right now to do this. So we give tax incentives and tax breaks to the millions of dollars right now in the city. They go to people who landmark their houses or people who get Class 6A incentives. We can give those same type of incentives to our elders to make sure that they can stay in the place that they've known and age with dignity and respect. So I would seek to change some of those and move some of those resources to make sure that our elders can stay in the community. Seriously, we can just carve out an elderly district. You know, you can put an age or you can put a number about how many years people have lived there, and then give those the same incentives to the people we are giving who have millions already but decide to landmark their house. We have to reprioritize
Time.
Our resources. Thank you.
I wanted to make sure you got that word out. That's a tough one. That's a tough one. I've had trouble with that myself. All right. Thank you all. I appreciate you all's patience. Is everybody having a nice time? Are you getting the information that you need? Thank you. Thank you. I'm learning a lot myself. I am. I'm sorry, love. Midnight. Congressman said, no. No, it's 4 p.m. Okay. Maybe earlier is what I'm being told. I think they're getting impatient with me. All right, anyway, let's move along, okay? Change topics. Let's talk about reparations. All right, and so this time we will start the questioning or the responses with the congressman, right? Because we started with the state rep this last time. Okay, here is a question. Evanston has implemented a program of reparations. Do you support reparations, and will you begin... I can't read this writing, to develop a plan for reparations.
As a member of...
I'm sorry, Congressman, can we do 60 seconds on this one?
Sure.
Okay.
As a member of Congress, I have been a co-sponsor of H.R. 40, which is a bill that would appoint a commission to look at making recommendations to the full Congress for reparations at the national level. I'm a proud sponsor of that. I think the Congress and the nation needs to have that discussion, that debate, and face the reality of our past and all of the implications that come from having enslaved people since 1619. Two, I commend the city of Evanston for their pilot initiative to look at the area of housing in terms of reparations and what can be done to make up for past discrimination, exclusion. I also welcome other initiatives at the city level to look at what would be fair in Chicago to look at in terms of reparations initiatives so Time. That we acknowledge the history and look at options for repairing.
I'm sorry, Congressman, but H.R. 40 has been sitting there 30 years. We need to really address this on a local level so that we can become a model for cities all across this country and for our federal government who's stagnating bills for 30 years at a time. This is a pressing concern, and we deserve repairment because when you look at every other ethnic group that has been tortured or tormented or whatever case that they've been in, they've been repaired but us. And I'm going to take it a step further. One of the things that we would do under our administration is we're going to have an office for African descendants of slaves. We need an office for the Ados community because when you look at the Office of New Americans and other ethnic groups, African Americans should get the same type of treatment and coordinate all departments to enhance the lives of folks all throughout this city. So we're going to put an office in place. We're going to put the most robust plan for reparations in this city that has ever been seen and become a model for the rest of the country.
So I'm the only person in the state of Illinois that took an entire budget and built it around Black lives. You can look at it. It's called Budget for Black Lives. So, yes, I support reparations, and I've taken the multi-billion-dollar budget, the county level, and built an entire budget around the people who have been harmed the most in this country. And it was that model that the president of the Board of Commissioners used it to establish our equity plan. And that's why there are millions of dollars in violence prevention. We can retire up to $1 billion in medical debt. I passed the Just Housing Ordinance that ended discrimination against those who were seeking housing who were formerly incarcerated. That ordinance sat on the county board for 4 years. I passed it in 4 months. I also support, here's what we prioritize. Members of this society, black men in particular, who were tortured by this government, the Chicago Police Department, they get reparations first under a better, stronger, safer Chicago under a Brandon Johnson administration.
Yes, not only do I support reparations, it's a big part of my safety plan. So I talked about it earlier, needing to put hundreds of millions of dollars into violence intervention. What I didn't mention is that's part of NCOBRA's racial redress or reparations plan. Some of the details around that is that we would give $600 a week to our most vulnerable black, mainly black men, brown women as well, but our most vulnerable residents to incent them to, again, have job training, trauma-informed care, to make sure that their families have the appropriate wraparound services. Those are some things that we can do immediately and start to put a dent in a lot of the crime and a lot of the social issues that we have that we know come out of vestiges of not only slavery, but racism.
Time.
We also need to hold banks accountable as well, especially around redlining.
State Rep, go right ahead.
Listen, black folks in America are the only people who came here as a commodity. And we have to be honest about that. And so reparations should not be a conversation that we're negotiating. It has to happen. And I don't need a task force to tell me that, or a disparity study to tell me that, or a non-binding resolution to tell me that. Black folks in this country, in this city, deserve it. Furthermore, with all respect to my colleagues, violence prevention money is not reparations. It's not. It's the bare minimum. And so absolutely, we need it on day one. We need to begin the work And if Congress can't move fast enough, the city needs to do it and then invoice the federal government for what they owe us too.
Thank you for that. Let's change subjects once again. There are a lot of concerns and questions, not just here from the church community and those who are here in the audience, but also those on the live stream in light of what happened to Tyre Nichols down in Memphis. I'm going to give you guys 90 seconds for this question. And we started with the congressman last time. We start with you, Mr. Green. Okay, hang on. Let me ask. I'm going to read a couple of these. The questions are kind of all the same, but I just want you to hear what folks have to say. What preventative measures are being taken, or would you like to take, or would you like to see taken, to keep from happening what happened in Memphis, to make sure that it doesn't happen here? Hang on. Let me read another one. In light of what happened with Laquan McDonald and George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, I'm having trouble reading this. What is your plan to address the community and citizens who should have fair treatment and justice? I'll read one more. These are all kind of the same thing. Black males' fairness to employment. Wanted to know about the consent decree, which is kind of wrapped into this policing issue. Another individual says, hearing a lot about safety. Wanting to know, how do we keep from what's happened in Memphis from happening here? Mr. Green, I'll let you start. When we do 90 seconds.
We're going to need 120 seconds for the question.
20 minutes.
You know, what happened to Tyre Nichols is disgusting, but it wasn't shocking because we've seen it over and over again, and it's happening in these neighborhoods each and every day. But a lot of these folks might not have been killed or might have not been on camera, so we don't see it. But they're in jail for disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, etc. Guess what? I was one of those protesters who was framed and charged with resisting arrest. So whether we were talking about cases like Laquan McDonald that I lead, that was one of my first big activist cases that I helped lead, whether it was George Floyd, whether it was all these different cases, we need to understand our role in this. And our role in this is to stop basing our budget off of police. Stop, and the majority of the candidates in this race all want to increase the police budget when it's already $2 billion a year. Over-policing neighborhoods does not mean that we will have public safety. You cannot police your way out of poverty. You cannot continue to try to contain it to a certain number. We have to address the root causes of what's going on. And if you invest in people and invest in young people, invest in a block club infrastructure, if you invest in allowing those neighborhoods and those blocks to police themselves, that's our way to public safety. We got a lot of work to do, and we cannot continue to allow our politicians to only use their communications department, but they're not using their policy department to take action. And we need action right now at every level of government.
So, you know, raising a family in Chicago is hard enough when you're black. And I don't know if there's anyone else in this race that has more an incentive for our city to be safer and better than someone who's raising black children on the west side of Chicago. Again, we're talking about million-dollar blocks where we have spent more money locking up black people than educating our people. And that's why, again, I'm on record, the Justice for Black Lives, where we call out the state's addiction on jails and incarceration, that we should be directing our resources to do what works. That's how we prevent it, is that we make sure that we eliminate this addiction that we have to jails and incarceration. Right? Look, 40%, over 40% of the violence that happens in the city of Chicago happens in 6% of the neighborhood. Like, we know where the violence is more likely to take place. But here's what we also have to make sure that we're doing, and I've released this in my budget plan. You got to invest in people, you all. We have to. I'm committed to that. And you're going to have to demand that those at the top pay their fair share. Look, this addiction on jails and incarceration has been an abysmal failure. It's not just that we spend more per capita. It's that we do have politicians that continue to recycle the failed policies of the old that continues to leave families behind. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to tell you the truth all the time. And what I want for my family, I want for every single family in the city of Chicago, a better, stronger, safer city that does not rely upon the failures of policies to be
time.
The answer to the failures. Thank you.
So when I forced myself to watch that video of Tyree Nichols, as a mother, you know, as a grandmother, when I heard him crying out for his own mother, it was gut-wrenching. It was heart-wrenching. What it told me, what I saw this whole picture, and you talked about not doing some of the things that happened in Memphis. There are some things I do want to do. I'll get to that. What we saw is a devaluation of the life of a black man. We've seen that over and over and over again. We also saw a devaluation of five black men who were officers, hear me out here, who for the first time were fired really quickly, charged really quickly, because their blue lives didn't respect their black lives. And it's uplifting and making sure that we value black lives is important. I've been showing this over the last 6.5 years, even before I became alderman. Don't have people pander for your votes right now. Look to see what people have been doing over the years and what they've been doing, raising the minimum wage, bringing 400,000 black and brown women into an affordable wage is something that I've done. Like I said, Michael Reese bringing $25 million to our education, affordable housing on site,
time.
Changing Congress to Ida B. Wells, Lakeshore Drive to DeSable Drive. I can go on and on, but I'll continue to do that on the fifth floor.
So I didn't watch the video. I couldn't watch the video. I can't watch the video. I can't bring myself to do it, but I know what it looks like. I know what it sounds like. And unfortunately, many of us know what it feels like. Years ago, 2002, I was leaving this building. I went to church in this, and I went to church here. I was leaving this building. I was 16 years old. I got pulled over on 95th and Parnell and got pulled out of the car in a rainstorm, thrown on the pavement with a gun to my head by the police because I fit a description. This is the story of way too many people in our city over and over again. What happened in Memphis is not peculiar to Memphis. It's a Chicago thing that we've seen over and over again, and we've done nothing about it. And so I'm really just pressed that people who have said nothing about it happening in Chicago now have something to say about Memphis. It happened here first, and it happens here every single day. And so, listen, we've got to be serious about how we got here and what we need to do. It's not enough just to change policing in Chicago. We have to change Chicago because we have systems and processes in place that continue to oppress people. And the Chicago Police Department is just one piece of how that comes to fruition through our systems. We have a much longer way to go, and we got a much better job to do.
I watched the video yesterday, and it's horrendous. I remembered the shooting of Laquan McDonald, which happened about a mile from my home. And it's depressing, it's angering, and it provoked all sorts of trauma, especially among black people, without a doubt. This is what I was thinking about when I was putting together with people that I consulted our public safety plan, how to strike a balance between justice and safety. And some of the things that are in my plan that I want to share with you, seeking to prevent this from ever happening again, unfortunately, it's likely to happen again, however, is the following components: training on de-escalation, trauma-informed responses and bias training, investments in mental health and wellness and civilian crisis responses, essential, investments in community violence prevention and intervention,
I come from that sector. Compliance with the consent decree to have constitutional policing. My public safety plan calls for fully staffing, but also training civilian crisis responders, the investments that we need in mental health for residents and officers and their wellness, and investment above all in communities and Time. Violence prevention programs.
Thank you all. Let's change or shift to another subject that has been coming up a lot of questions. The one I think that we all think about, especially in light of the pandemic and all the stresses that we internalize every day, mental health. I believe, Mr. Green, we're starting with you this time. Is that right?
Well, I started last year.
Okay, so
but
then...
I can start again.
No. You're taking advantage of our friendship. Don't do that. I'm sorry, Commissioner. We're starting with you this time. Okay.
Does that mean we're friends, Evelyn?
I suppose, in some kind of way.
I don't want to lose votes.
Well, wow. And I don't want to get arrested, so there we go. All righty. A lot of folks have concerns about the issues of mental health. And this has been wrapped into the issue of public health, so to speak. One individual asked, what is your process, and I think they mean plan, for having mental health clinics that have been closed reopened, but also mental health clinics in schools so that local communities have affordable access to that mental health and also to that type of public health? Well, yeah. Let's do 60 seconds on that.
Yeah, thank you for that question. So my older brother, who was my hero, Leon, was an incredible individual, first person in our family to go to college, but he had untreated trauma, and he died addicted and unhoused. I believe that if the services were available for my brother, he would be alive to see his grandchildren today. As a teacher, as an organizer, I fought to make sure that social workers and counselors were available in our schools. Look, I fought the last administration when he closed our mental health facilities. Been fighting this administration because she refuses to reopen them. Under a better, stronger, safer Chicago, I'm not only committed to opening mental health centers, but they have to be publicly funded and ran so that public employees have access to those jobs. So regardless of who is the mayor, so once my terms are over, the next mayor can't just shut them down. Fully committed to mental health services. I've done it as a teacher, as an organizer, as a Cook County Commissioner, and you have my commitment when I'm your mayor. Thank you.
Yeah, as I spoke earlier, I said, you know, over 50% of calls to 911 are for nonviolent issues like mental health insecurities, which is why under my leadership in the City Council, we helped start a pilot for mental health first responders. That program needs to be escalated. It's only in several districts throughout the city, maybe a few hours. We've actually given this administration allocated resources to escalate that. That needs to be a priority. We need to do that again. The mental health clinics. You know, I've visited every single one of those mental health clinics with my colleague, and they're under-resourced. They're under-resourced, and then you turn around and say, you know, that they're not serving as many people. Well, the reality is they actually serve as many mental health patients as what our FQHCs, where a lot of our money is going to. But we could resource them more, which is why I advocated to make sure that we had more resources in this last budget for that. And bringing more mental health clinicians there. So mental health has been a priority. It will continue to be a priority under my administration.
I'm the only candidate in this race to have presented a standalone mental health plan to the people of Chicago. And through that plan, I talk about a few things. One, reopening and opening 20 clinics around the city, not necessarily where the old clinics were, but based on data where the clinics need to be. I've also talked about four of those clinics being 24 hours, 365 days a year, so that they can meet people where they are. One on the north side, one on the south side, one on the west side, and one in and around our downtown central business district. I've also talked about making sure that people can make appointments to the CDPH mental health clinics online or via an app. Right now you have to walk in, fill out some paperwork, and come back the next day. that doesn't work for somebody that's in crisis. I've also talked about making sure that we can have a responder model with mental health professionals within CPD. So when people call CPD and they're having, or call 911 because they're having a mental health episode, that we're not sending a cop with a gun and a badge to their door to make the situation worse. We've talked about mobile units to make sure that they can rove around the city and help out people. And I also think they need to exist in the schools, in the libraries, in the parks. Some people in this race say they need to exist in the police station. That's not the right thing, right place for them to be.
There is a greater need for mental health services today than ever before, an unprecedented need. Why? Because of COVID and everything that that brought to so many communities, especially black and brown communities. The only way to provide more services would be for the city and the county to collaborate. Why? The city has 24 clinics that it provides a variety of services, including services for women and children. The county has 14 clinics, many of them in the city of Chicago. They exist already. I am for expanding access to mental health beyond reopening of the shuttered clinics. We've got to make it more accessible where people are already familiar. I would also explore working collaboratively with FQHCs, as the Alderwoman has pointed out. Critical to being able to provide more services is hiring more clinicians, thus the importance of collaboration between the city and the county, and to do it urgently.
Well, you know, one of the biggest problems that we're having with, you know, I know they're talking about just expanding services that are already there, is that you have a lot of privatizers who are really ruining the system. We need to bring back public mental health clinics in this city that are under our control and not the privatizers making all of the money and not giving the care that's needed in our community. So we are committing to do that. And we're also committing to $100 million investment from the police budget, taking it away from the police budget, to put into a pure responder unit to hire social workers to respond to 911 calls for mental health, homelessness, domestic abuse, transport, et cetera. We must really tackle this problem in our neighborhoods. We have to invest and put in models, you know, for this. This really matters to me, as my grandfather, whose birthday is January 31st, was someone who suffered from mental health issues, and he always wandered off. He went missing.
Time.
Dang, Evelyn, I was in a passion story. All right, I'll talk about it later.
Y'all see what I deal with all the time now? With these guys, I show up and this is.
If that's how she treats friends, Lord have mercy.
We're going to talk later. It's all good.
You know, you don't want to get started about me standing in that baseball field waiting for you to show up and freezing my patatas off.
Got it.
And I don't talk to just anybody about my patatas. I got nothing but a bad sense of humor, so just get used to it. All right. Listen, thank you so much. And I appreciate your wonderful questions, and I appreciate your impassioned responses. That's really great. This is fun. Everybody having a great time? I'm having a blast. All right. Let's move to another topic. Okay? I heard someone say yes. What topic you want to talk about? Okay. Restorative justice. All right. Let's talk about restorative justice. We talked about a little bit about this juvenile justice and making sure that juveniles are held accountable for the crimes that they allegedly commit. In some cases, they have committed. Let's talk about the juvenile justice system, how you address that. And let's do 90 seconds, because I want to throw in there as well the issue of crime on the CTA. So we're going to do a twofer. We're going to do restorative justice, okay? But we also going to talk about crime in particular on the CTA. And Alderman, I believe you are first up. I think we should do 90 seconds. Would you agree?
It's fine. Thank you. So definitely restorative justice should be a huge part of how we deal with not only our youth, but anybody who's had a brush with crime or anything. I think, you know, how we treat people is how they return that energy to us. And so I think we have to have humane ways to deal with justice. That being said, we also have to have and hold people accountable. I think part of that, again, is addressed in my plan when we talk about violence intervention. That is important. Bringing our young kids, making sure they know that they're loved, that they have hands on them, that they feel where they are loved by the community. So part of that plan is bringing the entire community together. Again, incentivizing folks with resources in order to do that, making sure that we've got wraparound services, making sure that we've got trauma-informed care, because lots of trauma around our individual youth and just people in general. So you have to have trauma-informed care, also making sure that the family is taken care of and wraparound services. So we have a very detailed plan about making sure, and restorative justice is part of that plan, but bringing the whole community together to hold individuals responsible. I think that's the most way, unless we're going to be back here in 20 years
time
talking about this again. So that's how I would leave with that.
I believe that none of our young people are irredeemable, and we have to pour into them. Give them the resources and the tools and the ability to be productive members of our society. Listen, when I was in law school at DePaul, I spent every Friday night for a year doing restorative justice peace circles at the JTDC, the Juvenile Temporary Detention Center. A lot of us remember it as the Audi home, right? Every Friday night for a year, and talking to specifically young men who had been detained for everything from aggravated assault to murder. And what I've learned through that process was that they're crying out for resources. But in a society and a system where we spend $30,000 a year to educate them, but $60,000 a year to put them in jail, something is wrong with our priorities. And we need to be, you know, we need to find a way to move through that. We created the juvenile justice system here in Cook County 100 years ago, right on Halston Street, where the Hull House is now at the UIC campus. I think it's time for us to go back now and figure out if what we're doing is working, what we can do different, how we can rebuild our young people and our communities at the same time. As far as the CTA and crime is concerned, I'm going to try to do both of those. Listen, the truth of the matter is that...
You know what?
Nope.
Stop.
Okay.
I was trying to follow directions. So
okay.
Stop, and then we'll double back.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Because that's really not fair. That's a lot of to have to do in 90 seconds.
All right. Well, I'll yield the rest of my time. Chewy.
Disinvested communities is what produces juveniles in the system. The lack of opportunities in neighborhoods across Chicago, especially in the poorest neighborhoods. Restorative justice has to be one of the mainstays of juvenile justice. That is, what do we do with young people once we detect that they're involved in certain conduct, whether it's gang membership or drug dealing or, you know, carjacking, armed robberies, etc.? Usually, by that time, it's really hard. This happens because we don't invest in time. Some of the partnerships that need to be had if we invested in community, and my approach is comprehensive community investment and planning, is to work with schools, to work with nonprofits, and to make those connections. One of the reasons I introduced in Congress a $10 billion bill called Connecting Jobs to Youth is because of the wraparound service character of helping young people keep jobs by providing them transportation, by providing them services like mental health, by providing them childcare, by providing them things that they need to be successful in keeping those jobs. Again, the operating mandate is that it has to be comprehensive and that communities in Chicago need to be invested in.
Let me first say, you really can't
believe in restorative justice if you believe in constantly increasing the police budget year after year after year, and you're not spending double or triple what you're spending on that actually in people throughout the communities. We got to make that clear. And I want everyone, I push everyone to really look at each candidate and their plans when it comes to their increase of police and police presence and police budget, because that means that you don't believe in the or have faith in people, that people can become better. And the investment into people must be there. When we are talking about, you know, earlier I talked about a youth intervention department so that we can put young people on the right path. But then we also got to talk about having a reentry program, right? So that folks who return home have the resources they need. I had a program in a Kewanee prison where we went in and we affirmed them and we taught them about their resumes and their business plans. And I have graduates right now today out with good paying jobs, housing, et cetera, who just did 20 years in jail, who graduated our program. We must make sure that we're investing into people and giving them the resources that they need so that they can get on the right path. And we have to create good paying jobs. We have to stop saying, oh, well, here's $15, $20 an hour. Then when they deny it, say they don't want to work. No, they need the opportunity to live a middle class life so they can provide for their families.
Time.
And that's what we're going to do in our administration. Thank you.
So, again, as a teacher, I've looked into the eyes of young boys and girls and the life that continues to get sapped out of them because of the failures of the politics of old. That's why, as an organizer, I've fought to make sure within the teacher's contract that we have restorative justice, because this school-to-prison pipeline is real. We had to challenge teachers who were biased towards the behavior of black children. I have my middle son, Ethan. He's the one that is making me a better parent. I'll just say it like that. And so having the consciousness and the cultural competency to be able to deal with our children in particular, especially our boys, it's important. And that's why we have to begin to close the gap between job opportunities and education. Do you all know there are 30,000 vacancies right now just in manufacturing alone? So using our closed facilities as a way to train our young people up to be able to access the W-2s that ultimately provides economic security, that is restorative justice. It's not so much just looking at the particular offense. It's the offense of the system that continues to create the type of behavior that we want to eradicate. And the way you do it, and I have it laid out in my budget plan, without raising property taxes, as your mayor, a better, stronger, safer Chicago is going to be an invested Chicago. Thank you.
Okay. And as I promised, we'll start with State Rep. Let's talk about CTA and crime. And let's do 60 seconds on that, everybody.
Yeah, so for those of us who ride CTA, we've seen an increase in crime. We've seen an increase in untoward behavior on the CTA. And there are a few things I think we need to do up front. First off, this current private security contract that the mayor has inked, $100 million in private security on the CTA, $70 million for the actual security guards and $30 million for the dogs, the German Shepherds, which I've called a throwback to George Wallace's Alabama, right? We shouldn't be doing that in Chicago. Secondly, there are 30,000 cameras on the CTA right now. The problem is that they're not connected, and there is no real way to have them work together, right? And so it's a very small technology fix. We got to put the money in it to make sure that the cameras and are being able to talk to each other. I've called for bringing back CTA transit ambassadors, and also making sure that the CTA is part of the beat of the regular beat of the cops who patrol the area. But listen, the truth of the matter. Oh, well, there it is.
So, a couple things on the CTA. The service has really deteriorated, and that makes me angry because we bailed out the CTA over the last almost 3 years and Metro. But the CTA in particular. And we see conduct going on in the trains and buses that we haven't seen before. That's got to change. I would convene the CTA and Metra and the other agencies
to hold them accountable. We have to realize, however, that many people, because of the growth in homelessness, are resorting to transit as at least a temporary shelter to be. I think that in addition to moving police officers from the citywide units to be in the neighborhoods, getting out of their cars, getting to know people, as in community policing, is a part of that, freeing them up to be near the stations. And then lastly, I would increase the number of operators, conductors, and maintenance personnel so that the trains don't stink, so that the buses are clean and running on time.
Well, what's going on in CTA is terrible. One of the first things that we would do in our administration is we would call for a state of emergency on public transit. We need to free up dollars so that we can actually send a mass amount of folks to evaluate people on the trains and pair them with services that they need. That needs to happen. And that's partner with the reopening up the mental health clinics, as well as a budget so that we can have temporary housing so that folks can get paired with that. You know, when you look at CTA right now, it's a mobile homeless shelter with a lot of folks who have mental health problems, and we need to address it, get them off of the train so that they can get the services. And we're going to make it easier to get services. We're going to put resource kiosks at every station so that folks can tap on that kiosk and find a service that they are needed. We're also going to have a peacekeepers agency that rides the trains to mitigate any concerns. And we're going to have a massive jobs program for ex-offenders and veterans. Right? We need to make sure that we're addressing our shortages and make it easier and make our workers feel valued.
Look, it's unreliable, and that's why it's unsafe. It's stagnant. And as Representative Buckner has indicated, those of us who rely upon public transportation, when our families don't feel safe and our workers don't feel safe, that's a problem. But here's the thing, though. Look, the transportation infrastructure it can be restored and rebuilt. Right. And we can do that by increasing bus lanes where we have prioritization for our bus lanes with bus signals that give buses the ability to have preference as we move. Right. But we also have to make sure that we are providing more infrastructure with actual personnel. Again, closing the gap between jobs and education. 18 years old, CDL, 21 to operate a larger vehicle. If we can actually use spaces in this city to build a brand new neighborhood, $2.5 billion, for white folks to be able to go somewhere and have a playground, and wealthy folks to be able to have a playground, and we can rebuild our infrastructure to make sure that we have a reliable, safe transportation system, you can't call yourself a world-class city.
Time.
Under my administration, we're going to have a better, safer transportation system.
So look, in order to have a world-class transportation system, we have to take a regional approach. The federal government, other folks, the state who give us resources, see us as competing with each other, the CTA, PACE, the RTA. We have to have a regional approach so that we can take advantage of economies of scale. So that's one thing. I fought to save the 43rd Street bus in my neighborhood when a group of my elders, seniors, came to me and said, you know, they're going to shut down our bus and we're not going to even be able to get to church on Sundays. So a more connectivity, more equitable distribution of the resources that we do have is also something that we need to do in order to have a world-class city. I'll continue to fight for the least of those who don't have that connectivity when I'm mayor and on the fifth floor.
Nothing wrong with that. I'm all about that. Thank you for that. We're going to do two more questions, 60 seconds each, okay? Dealer's choice. What do you want to do first? Dealer's choice. What do you want to do? Okay, let's do this. Let's do maternal mortality. And we'll start with the congressman this time. The infant mortality rate for African-American babies is reported to be almost three times that of white babies in Chicago. A contributing factor is the lack of safe birthing spaces in areas such as South Shore, Inglewood, and here in Washington Heights. What is your plan for increasing comprehensive maternal health services in predominantly black and brown neighborhoods that can reduce mortality risk for both newborns and moms?
60 seconds?
Yes.
Okay. As a former Cook County Commissioner, whose purview has been the public health system, I understand the important role of public health. And it's a perfect reason why there has to be more collaboration between the Cook County Board President and the mayor's office. And I am perfectly ready to walk across the hall on the fifth floor to have those conversations. We need to invest in public health. The infant mortality rate of black children is higher than the others, as you have suggested, but so is the rate of black women who die from complications of pregnancy. So I would appoint a group of experts and community practitioners to advise us on what new initiatives we need to make to ensure that we provide the right services for both children when they are in the womb and, of course, mothers, so that we lower those horrific rates of mortality.
You know, he's definitely right that there needs to be a partnership with the city and the county. And when I'm mayor, I'm going to work with our commissioner here, Brandon Johnson, to do so. But, you know, and we must make sure that we're investing in this. You know, my best friend is about to have a child in 3 days, right? And she's choosing to do it at home because of the care. And that's where a lot of black young mothers are starting to do throughout the country. Because we're not stepping up and we're not making sure that there are better spaces and safer spaces to have children. And then also, we got to talk about health care too, right? We got to make sure that the city of Chicago moves forward a care plan so that we can bridge the gap for everyone that doesn't have health care in this city. And that's one of the biggest pieces for us. Everyone should have health care in the city of Chicago. Now, county has, you know, their plan, but we have many different folks, whether they're making under a certain
time
amount or in the middle, that doesn't have health care, and Chicago is going to provide it.
Yeah, I'm going to try to read through this quickly because I actually believe that the woman, Alderwoman Sophia Keene, obviously has a lot more to say about it, but from maybe a very personal way. And so I'm going to try to be thoughtful about this as a man. My wife, watching her deliver, changed my life. I saw the Holy Ghost when she went through that. Believe black women in particular when they express pain. That's the problem with our systems, right? That's why my wife has become a doula, working with midwives to provide that type of care that once upon a time provided the type of sensitivity and understanding, particularly when it comes to black women especially. But it also requires us to expand access to health care. And that's why, as Cook County Commissioner, I've expanded county care as a result of the Affordable Care Act, so that we have access to good care, but also access to health centers that are thoughtful and sensitive and culturally competent to care for our black and brown women in particular. Thank you.
Yeah. Certainly sensitive to healthcare and access to healthcare, which is why I helped to try and save Mercy Hospital. Didn't see a lot of folks here out there with me then, but that was an institution in our community, in the Bronzeville community, that we allowed to close. On this administration, allowed a $1 billion company to get out of its commitment to our community. That's just wrong. I will continue to fight for things like that. We stood up $100 million at McCormick Place, $100 million that served three or four people. By the way, that contract went to a majority contractor, no black, brown subcontractors. And meanwhile, you allow an institution that wasn't suffering from people coming into the building or to the hospital
time
to close in the middle of a pandemic. That cannot happen. That won't happen on my watch.
Alderwoman King is right. I stood with her during the Mercy fight, and it was unconscionable the pushback that we got from this administration. The fact that they were okay with letting that hospital go. Listen, when we talk about maternal mortality and what it looks like in our community, I've got to take this time to shout out my colleague in Illinois House, the Dean of the House, Mary Flowers, because Mary has fought for generations to make sure that we can move the needle along in this. We know that black women have a 45% higher maternal mortality rate, and we know that out of that percentage, 80% of those deaths are preventable. They would be prevented in any other community with any other demographic of people in this city, right? So we got to do better. Everyone here, I think, gave the right answer about collaboration. The city and CDPH has been so siloed that it really refuses to work with the county and refuses to work with IDPH at the state level, right? And so I think there are things that we can do to increase the resources to our safety nets, places like St. Bernard, places like Jackson Park Hospital, South Shore Hospital, and Roseland Hospital, to make sure that we're doing better.
Okay, this is going to be our last question, and then we will move to, you will have, after this question, which will be 60 seconds, then you will have 60 seconds for a closing remark, whatever you would like to share as we finish up. This question is about economic development. Mr. Green, we're going to start with you. I believe that's where we need to be, right? I think I wrote that down right. All right. Sometimes I can't keep these things in straight, but I'll write it. Here we go. This is a question from our audience here. In balance with community investment, despite 2.5 years of COVID-19, construction projects have skyrocketed, and project completion rates appear to have accelerated unlimited number in communities like Fulton Market, River North, and the Elston and Clybourne corridors. In your first 180 days, what actions will you take to fast-track projects on corridors such as 71st Street, 79th Street, 103rd, K-Town, Madison, and what will you do to make sure that the citizens that are in those areas can realize the benefits of that development? Let's do 60 seconds.
Well, you know, one of the things is we got to gut a lot of departments in the mayor's office and remove some of the heads of, you know, these departments. Working with the city when you have an economic development piece is very hard. I know because I'm working with them right now, and we've been stagnated for the last couple of years, maybe because I'm running against them. But, you know, this is an important issue, right? We have to step in and we have to be intentional to move forward projects. We need, these communities are suffering and need economic development. We have to remove the red tape. I talk about this in economic development. I talk about this in small businesses. This shouldn't take that long to be able to build something that the community wants. And we also need to go to the community and have outreach and have meetings and do more promotion to talk about how, what type of quality of life the communities want. We need to build quality of life plans all throughout the city of Chicago, where folks come and say, these are the things that my community needs, and we need to move forward measures to remove the red tape and do so.
Look, we have to do a better job, and this is why I believe that I'm uniquely qualified as an organizer to collaborate and listen so that we understand the needs of the various communities, right? Look, the economic development or the business of the city of Chicago is the education of the city of Chicago. If we're not creating enough W-2s, there's no clientele to patronize the businesses that we want. So by creating jobs, and we can do this within the first 180 days, there is so much vacancy. We can do this in a collaborative way. Workforce development, putting the vacancies in the abandoned buildings back on the tax rolls by creating opportunities for young men and women to actually develop those homes. And then we incentivize individuals to purchase those homes by giving them down payment assistance like my wife and I had. $80,000 was our combined income. We needed two government programs to purchase a home. If we're going to have a safe, affordable, stronger city, you have to have people with W-2s. You do that by collaborating with all entities to create the opportunities that are already available for us. Thank you.
So inequity didn't happen to us in a vacuum. It was strategic. And we have to meet that with an equal and intentional strategic way out of that. I can talk about what I've been doing over the last 6.5 years. Again, the Michael Reese development, there are 4 striking developments in the city of Chicago. Michael Reese, the Obama Library, 78, and Lincoln Yards. The reason ours is being called the most equitable development in the country, one of them, is because we work with the community to make sure that the community and the developer saw an upside, which is why we have a $25 million commitment to education, which is why we have a commitment to 20% affordable housing on site. Those types of things I will continue to do intentionally. I will also tell you about the billions of dollars of cranes that are going in my ward from downtown Bronzeville, in Hyde Park, even during the pandemic. Those resources are being distributed equitably. In my ward, 40% is like the floor. So I have 40% participation, which is unheard of in the city. I've been doing that and working with contractors intentionally, sitting down with them and making sure that the people who represent the city have to be a part of the economic upside of it as well.
So I put forth a Main Streets plan in my economic plan that I released last week, which talks specifically about those corridors that was mentioned in the question. And it includes a number of things through investment, but a few things that are important to that is making sure that we go to Springfield and we remove the vacancy tax credit loophole, where folks are able to keep commercial buildings in our historical corridors empty and get paid for it while our communities continue to fester. Listen, the city has put money in the places where they see is important. Hundreds of million dollars into developments like the 78. Why are we building a new community when we need to put money in the ones we already have? How about the other 77, right? That's a conversation that we need to have, and we need to push this administration to do that. I agree, we got to make sure that black contractors are at the top of this thing too, not just as subcontractors, but as prime contractors. Cut us in or cut it out, right? That needs to be the baseline for us. And then furthermore, I'll say we spend a lot of time talking about Invest Southwest, but the truth of the matter is that we've seen for years and years a divest Southwest. And when I say divest Southwest, I mean black folks are going to Midway Airport, buying the Southwest Airlines ticket and leaving, going down south and never coming back. That will change under my administration.
First of all, we've got to streamline the coordination of the Department of Planning, the Department of Housing, the Department of Water, and other departments. Critical. They are holding up progress and projects, the ones that you referenced. Very important. Two, I want to focus on the larger picture about economic development, and that is opportunities, of course, in manufacturing, but also in the growing tech sector. There will be thousands and thousands of jobs available in this sector. They don't require a college education, but we need to build a pipeline for the jobs of the 21st century. Disadvantaged communities can benefit greatly. This is a wonderful opportunity, but we've got to get working on it now so that we take advantage of the emergence of those jobs, because it's going to grow phenomenally.
All right. Thank you. So what we're going to do now is we're going to end the way we began. This time, you all will have an opportunity to kind of sum up whatever you would like to share with those who are here and also on the live stream. We did this alphabetically, so we'll start with the state rep and then move across.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the time, and once again, sorry for my tardiness. Listen, we are at an inflection point in this city, and we have a real choice on who we want to be. I often tell people that my mother moved here in 1955 from a small town called Drew, Mississippi. And she moved here because when my grandmother and my grandfather saw that in the town next door to them, Emmett Till was murdered, beaten, lynched, and thrown in the Tallahatchie River, they came to Chicago for safety and opportunity. That same safety and opportunity has eluded young people, black people, poor people in this city as we currently stand here. So we've got an opportunity to build and create a city where you live does not determine if you live. We can do it. We have the resources. We just need leadership and purpose to find a way to yes instead of getting stuck at no. Listen, I've done the work in Springfield. I've been able to ban assault weapons and ban ghost guns and pass the most comprehensive clean energy legislation in the history of this country. I will do the work, that same work, that same practical work as your next mayor in 2023. Thank you.
Thank you for giving us your Sunday afternoon and listening to us. First, I am the product of a movement for political empowerment in this city that goes back to the early 1980s when black and brown communities were empowered and we elected Harold Washington.
That's the type of leader that I want to be. I chose public service to deliver for the people that I represent. And they've included, yes, largely Latino populations, but others as well. And I've served everyone equitably. I have fought for everyone's rights. I want to become mayor of the city of Chicago because the investments that Congress and the White House have made in America can transform and rebuild Chicago equitably. The Infrastructure and Jobs Act, the manufacturing dollars there, as well as the technology dollars will offer the building blocks for a new Chicago with greater equity. I am progressive, I am a coalition builder, and I embrace all the people of Chicago. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm not a politician, so if you're looking for one, this isn't the campaign for you. We are tired of politicians because we haven't seen tangible results. If I ask you, do you feel safer than 4 years ago, I'm sure most people in this room are going to say no. And I want you to look at why and look at the leaders that are in power. We have someone at every level of government in this race. And I want to see where their urgency is right now, while they're campaigning and getting paid at the same time. It is time for real change so that we can create a better future we can all believe in. I was that young kid that you see out there that was in trouble, that wasn't on the right path. I was that kid. And now we have the opportunity to elect the youngest candidate or the youngest mayor ever of a large city in this country, but a progressive mayor that has a plan to change this city. We can do this together. I see hope in each and every one of you and our children and my three boys that I'm raising and sending to public schools. And I'm going to work each and every day to serve you right next to you throughout my time. Thank you, Evan.
Well, thank you again. I think it's actually quite powerful that this race is full of people of color. I think it's a testament to where we are going as a city. You know, but I was raised in a very large family. My father raised 10 of us. My parents were foster parents. We had one bathroom. Learned how to negotiate early in life, especially with my sisters. But I know what it's like to come home and we turn on the water and the water is not on. I know what it's like to have a long orange extension cord from one window to the other just so that the refrigerator stays on. No one should be too poor to live in one of the richest cities and one of the richest countries at the wealthiest time in the history of the world. That's why I'm running for mayor of Chicago. We got to put this tale of two cities to an end and usher in a better, stronger, safer Chicago. There's a reason, y'all, why my campaign is catching fire. Black, brown, white, it's multicultural, multigenerational. I'm happy to have the support of Delia Ramirez and Jonathan Jackson, independent political organizations. We're raising resources by bringing forth an agenda that people can be proud of. Listen, when I'm mayor of the city of Chicago, the table will be in my room. There'll be grits. Whether you like salt or sugar, the grits will be there. Thank you. BrandonForChicago.com.
Listen, with 16 of my colleagues leaving with so much dissension between this administration and everyone, we need a woman that leads with collaboration who can bring our city together. We can't have somebody flying the plane and building it at the same time. We've been there. We've done that. We saw how that is. I have a proven track record of getting things done, bringing people together, and doing so. I also know that we can have safety and justice, that we can build our downtown and build our neighborhoods, that we can prepare our kids for college and for the trades. Let me tell you, an equitable Chicago is a strong Chicago, and a strong Chicago is a safe Chicago. So punch 2, February 28th. Thank you.
Okay, can we have a round of applause for all of our candidates? Thank you so much. All of you stand, please. Now we've got some housekeeping. Thank you again. And thank you.